Old man Clemens was the meanest man in town. I've told you about old man Clemens, haven't I? Sort of yes, no. He lived on the other side of my grandmother. When I was a kid growing up, we didn't need ghost stories because we had stories about old man Clemens that we knew were true. My first encounter with old man Clemens was one day we were playing baseball in my grandmother's backyard. Somebody hit the ball, it went way into Mr. Clemens' yard, and I was assigned to go and get the ball. I should have been suspicious when all the other kids hid in the shrubbery at my grandmother's house. But I innocently walked over there and started to pick up the baseball. When I heard this terrifying scream, I looked on the porch. There was this little short man with wire-rimmed glasses and a red face screaming as loud as he could, "Get out of my yard!" And I turned and I ran as fast as I could, and I heard him say, "You kids, leave me alone!" Now that was bad enough. But the Chun children told us the rest of the story. Now, the Chuns lived on the other side of Mr. Clemens, and just between me and you, they were nothing but trouble. They were trouble kids. And the Chun kids told us, they said, "You know that their children who accidentally walk in Mr. Clemens' yard and they're never seen again." And they also said, not everybody knows this, but Mr. Clemens has a laboratory in his basement, like a mad scientist. Well, listen, I was scared to death of Mr. Clemens. I didn't want to have anything to do with old man Clemens. And then there was one night I was spending the night with my grandmother. And I was in the back bedroom, and I remember waking up in the middle of the night, and there were red flashes, just a light flashing all through the room. And I jumped out of bed. I didn't know what was going on. I ran into my grandmother's room, but she was not in her bed. Now, this is in the middle of the night. And I went out on her front porch, and there was my grandmother standing in her bathrobe. And a lot of the other neighbors had gathered standing in the front yard. And there was an ambulance and a police car in front of Mr. Clemens' house. And suddenly, I heard a terrifying scream. And I overheard somebody in the yard say, "They're getting ready to give him morphine. That's the only thing that will calm him down." And then somebody else said, "You know, he's got a steel plate in his head." And somebody else said, "The man's crazy." Well, that sealed the deal with me. Didn't want to have anything to do with old man Clemens until I was about 13 or 14 years old. And my grandmother told me one day, "Mr. Clemens needs someone to mow his grass, and I told him you would be glad to do it." Yeah, well, you know, when your grandmother says it, I knew I didn't have a choice. But the thing that was so bad about it, Mr. Clemens would not allow a gas lawnmower, a power mower. So you know what I had to use? One of those old-fashioned push mowers that had the big wheels, and you had to supply your own power. And not only that, Mr. Clemens didn't keep it maintained like he should. It was rusty, and I spent all day long trying to mow that man's grass. When I finally finished, and I remember this, I remember Mr. Clemens walking out, and he reached into his back pocket and he pulled out his billfold. And his billfold was covered with rubber bands. I never figured out what that was all about. But he took all those rubber bands off, and then with a shaking hand, he reached down in there and he pulled out three $1 bills. And he gave it to me, and he didn't say thank you. He didn't say you did a good job. He just gave it to me, and he turned and walked into the house. Well, but I had to mow his grass all summer. And then I was a little bit older, so I didn't have anything to do with Mr. Clemens until I was in high school. The Vietnam War was going on, and there was a lot of controversy about the war, about whether this was a just war, whether people ought to go to the war or not. And there was a guy that came to the high school one day, and he said, I want to tell you about a man who lives in this town, about a man who fought in the First World War, about a man who suffers every single day of his life because of the wounds that he received when he was in the war. He said this man was gassed. This man also received wounds from shrapnel. That was the steel plate that was in his head. This man cannot stand loud noises, which explained why I couldn't use a power more. But this man put his life on the line for our freedom, and we owe him more than a debt of gratitude. And for the first time in my life, I understood old man Clemens. The man wasn't crazy. The man was suffering every single day because of the wounds that he had when he fought way back in the First World War. Courtney read this scripture from 1 Peter. And Peter talks about a roaring lion seeking to devour us. Now see, when we were kids, we thought that old man Clemens was the roaring lion seeking to get us. But what we didn't realize was that he was dealing with demons every single day of his life. He was dealing with the wounds of a war. And Peter, in the fourth chapter, Courtney was reading from the fifth chapter, but in the fourth chapter, he talks about going through a fiery ordeal. And that's exactly what Mr. Clemens went through and what many of our veterans have gone through in a time of war. You know, we draw a clear line between Memorial Day and Veterans Day. We say Memorial Day is when we remember those who gave the ultimate sacrifice, for those who were killed defending our freedom in time of war. But Veterans Day is when we honor the brave men and women who have served but were blessed to be able to come home. But what we often don't stop to realize is the man or the woman who left to go and fight in the war is often not the same man or same woman who returns from the war. Many have come back like Mr. Clemens, scarred for life, having to deal with suffering and pain and demons, terrifying nightmares for the rest of their life. Joyce's father fought in the Second World War. He was a paratrooper. He landed in France shortly after D-Day. Everyone said that Joyce's father, who returned from the war, was not the same man who left to go and fight in the war. My father was in the Korean War, and my father always felt like that his sacrifice and service didn't quite measure up to the men who fought in the Second World War. And while on the surface you wouldn't have thought that it had any effect on my father, some of you might remember me telling a number of years ago I went home and cleaned out the attic at my parents' house. And with all of the junk and all of the boxes and all the things I was pulling out of that attic, I saw at the very end of the attic, as far as you could see, one solitary box. And I wondered, why is it there? And what is inside that box? Why did my father put it all the way at the end of the attic? And I saved it. I got everything else out. There was just that one box left. And I went and got that one box. And I remember my mother had a brick patio behind the back door. And I opened that box on the patio and I pulled out my father's part of his uniform when he was in service in Korea. And I wondered, why? Was there some reason that he wanted to take that part of his life and package it up and hide it away? What was he dealing with? When you think about the fact that so many are under extreme stress, they have had encounters with death, they come home with survivor's guilt. My buddy fighting beside me was killed. I survived. The plane went down. I was the only one who survived. And while many come home with physiological wounds, more come home with psychological wounds that we simply cannot see. The Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, estimates that in the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, 1 in 5 soldiers, airmen, sailors who return from that war have some form of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And they're also dealing with what we would call a moral injury. You see, fighting in a war with the intent of killing the enemy, which is killing another human being, leaves one with a sense of moral ambiguity. What is right? What is wrong? Dwight Eisenhower, on the eve of D-Day, shared these words with all of the troops, and they're powerful words. He said, "You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and the prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you." And then he named the 3 goals of the war, and all of these are noble and worthy goals. The elimination of the German war machine, the destruction of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed people of Europe, and the security for ourselves in a free land. D-Day was the defining moment of the war. It was the pivotal moment that the war turned. I don't think anybody would argue with the fact that without question, the Second World War was a battle between good and evil. It was a battle between right and wrong. It was a battle between tyranny and freedom, between oppression and liberty. Never has the line been more clearly drawn than it was in the Second World War. So this is what veterans deal with. So I'm a part of this great crusade. I'm a part of this noble and this worthy cause. I am doing what I am doing. I'm killing the enemy. I'm taking the life of another human being because I am helping to accomplish our goals. I'm doing what I know is wrong for what is right. That is moral ambiguity. And where do we draw the boundaries? And that's why veterans often return home plagued by all of these demons, dealing with moral shame. They have survivor's guilt. They have psychological wounds that are never fully healed. They are constantly fighting the roaring lion that is seeking to devour them. A number of us, 19 years ago, had a remarkable experience. We went to Oberammergau in Germany to see the Passion Play. I know a lot of you were part of that trip. We have another group going next year. But two of the people that went on that journey with us, if you remember, were Bush and Helen Linder. Dozier Linder. For those of you that knew Bush, and most of you did, I mean, he was the most calm, well-adjusted, kind, compassionate man. You would not think that he had any issues as a result of his time in service. But when we went to Germany in the year 2000, it was the first time that Bush Linder had been back to Germany since he left after being liberated from a POW camp. He was a prisoner of war. He left Germany, never thought he would return, but then we went back. And it was remarkable to be with him and to hear what he said about how beautiful Germany is and how beautiful the people are. And some of you might remember that we went to a little church. I think it was in Oberammergau. And that little church had a memorial room. And we walked into that room and there were pictures. There were pictures of men in Nazi uniforms. Now, I grew up, a lot of my friends had fathers who fought in the Second World War. I remember one daddy brought back all of this stuff he had collected, including a Nazi helmet. So when we would play war games, somebody would wear the Nazi helmet, and of course they would be the enemy. We would try to defeat them. We would have to kill that person. Because I grew up, you grew up, believing Nazis are the enemy, and they were the enemy. But I walked into that memorial room, and some of you might remember this. I saw all these pictures of these men in Nazi uniforms. But I didn't see the Nazi uniform. This man was a father. This man was a brother. This man was a son. This man was a dedicated member of the church. We didn't see them as the enemy. We saw them as other human beings. And I think that's what Bush saw 19 years ago, and that's why that experience for him was a catharsis, and he finally dealt with that moral ambiguity that he had been wrestling with for 55 years. The reason I'm saying all of this is I think this weekend we need to do more than just thank our veterans. Yes, we need to do that, but we need to try to understand the depth, the magnitude, the level of their sacrifice, and all of the issues that they go through and the battles that they continue to fight. We need to remember what they did on our behalf and how it still affects their lives. One of the greatest war movies of the 20th century was Saving Private Ryan. A lot of you saw that movie. Joyce and I don't like to go to war movies. I have a hard time with that. But our son, Knight, who is in the service, wanted to go see it, so we went to see it with him. You might remember the story. The story is based on a true story. There was a lady who had four sons. All four sons were fighting in the Second World War. Three of the boys had been killed. When General George Marshall saw that three of four sons had been killed, he decided that sacrificing another son was too much of a burden for one mother to bear. And so he sent a special mission. He sent a group in to save Private Ryan, to get him safely out of the battle so that he could go home to his mother. The man who was in charge of the mission was Captain John Miller, who was played by none other than Tom Hanks. It's a great story. It's a great movie. They lost many of the men on the mission, but finally they found Private Ryan. And he told him, he said, "You have to come with us." But you remember what Private Ryan did? He refused to go with them. He said, "No, because I have not completed my duty." Duty was the most important thing. He said, "I will not leave until I complete my assignment." And that assignment had to do with capturing a strategic bridge. And so Captain Miller decides to fight alongside Private Ryan. And they were able to save the bridge, to capture the bridge. But in the process, Captain Miller is mortally wounded. And in one of the most powerful, emotional scenes in cinematic history, as Captain John Miller is dying on the bridge, he looks up at the young private and he says, "Earn this. Earn this." And then the scene shifts to an old Private Ryan standing in the cemetery over the grave of Captain Miller, saying, "I hope I have earned it." He tried to live his whole life remembering the sacrifice that those men made for him. He asked his wife, he said, "Tell me I'm a good man. Tell me I've lived a good life. Tell me that I have earned it." I think about my friend James so often, who lived behind me in that little town in Alabama. You see, I was drafted, like everybody was drafted then, to go to Vietnam. But back then, the deal was, if you were going to college, they would defer your deployment. And so I was going to college. My family could afford to send me to college. James's family could not. James went to Vietnam. He never came back. I went to college. When I graduated from college, the war was winding down and the draft was over, and I didn't have to go. You don't think I think about that? You see, James was black. I often think about the fact that if I had been black, if I had been poor, then I would have gone. I think every day about those who gave their lives, who sacrificed so that I can be free. How do we deal with this moral ambiguity? How do we deal with this level of sacrifice? Well, we begin by realizing that the greatest sacrifice is that God's very own Son, only begotten Son, died on a sinner's cross so that we could have life and we could have freedom. And we should live every day in gratitude. We should live every day savoring every moment, being thankful for every breath, taking advantage of every opportunity to serve God and to honor Him and to love Him, because He gave His all for us. At the beginning of the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln invited Julia Ward Howe, an accomplished social rights activist who really advocated for the abolition of slavery, to come to Washington and to see the troops. And she was so troubled by what she saw She saw these young men, many of those were suffering, many of those had been wounded, who were struggling with this moral ambiguity. They were fighting for what they believed was right, but they were doing what they knew was wrong. And during the night, some of the most powerful words ever put to music were penned. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us live to make men free while God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Our God is marching on. Let us continue to serve. Let us continue to live our lives in gratitude. And let us put our trust in our triumphant God, who is always marching on.